Hello and greetings from Asheville, North Carolina. In case my voice is unfamiliar to you, I'm Dr. Han Lai, the founder and current spiritual director of Urban Dharma. Thanks to the wonders of technology, we have been able to share a good number of the programs we have offered the last 6 years in Asheville, and occasionally programs I have done elsewhere with this podcast. I hope you have found these programs educational, informative, and helpful to your own spiritual journey. I want to also take this opportunity to make a personal appeal to you to help us to continue to do what we have been doing here. Urban Dharma North Carolina is entirely 100% volunteer-based. We do not have any employees, and I am neither on the payroll of Urban Dharma, nor do I accept any offerings from the community. Our operating costs are as slim as it can be, but nonetheless, we still need your support and help. So, would you consider either a one-time donation, or better yet, become one of our sustaining members who give on a regular basis so that we can continue to give the gift of Dharma to any and all who need it? If you are ready to help today, please drop us a line at benefactors@udharmanc.com. Again, benefactors@udharmanc.com. Or visit our giving page on our website, www.udharmanc.com. Again, www.udharmanc.com. But if you're not in a position to make a donation today, you can still help us by simply telling someone else about this podcast. Help us reach more people so that we can share the Dharma even more widely than we are currently doing. And finally, thank you, and please enjoy the following teaching brought to you by Urban Dharma, North Carolina.
Hello, and welcome to the Urban Dharma NC podcast. This is part 5 of a series about karma, the Buddha's compassionate explanation of reality, that our thoughts and actions determine our future. Dorje Lopa and Dr. Han Lai will help us unpack this important concept and show how the Buddhist teachings on karma can help us live good and happy lives for ourselves and others, despite a feeling of living in difficult times.
All other sentient beings, boundless as the sky, especially those enemies who hate me, obstructors who harm me, and those who create obstacles on my path to liberation and omniscience. May they experience happiness and be separated from suffering. I will quickly establish them in a state of the most perfect and precious Buddhahood. All mother sentient beings, boundless as the sky, especially those enemies who hate me, obstructors who harm me, and those who create obstacles on my path to liberation and omniscience, may they experience happiness and be separated from suffering. I will quickly establish them in a state of the most perfect and precious Buddhahood. All mother sentient beings, boundless as the sky, especially those enemies who hate me, obstructors who harm me, and those who create obstacles on my path to liberation and omniscience, may they experience happiness and be separated from suffering. I will quickly establish them in the state of the most perfect and precious Buddhahood. Thus, until I achieve enlightenment, I perform virtuous deeds with body, speech, and mind. Until death, I perform virtuous deeds with body, speech, and mind. From now until this time tomorrow, I perform virtuous deeds with body, speech, and mind.
Page 6. In the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha most excellent, I take refuge until enlightenment is reached. By the merit of generosity and other perfections, may I attain Buddhahood for the sake of all sentient beings. In the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha most excellent, I take refuge until enlightenment is reached. By the merit of generosity and other perfections, may I attain Buddhahood for the sake of all sentient beings. In the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha most excellent, I take refuge until enlightenment is reached. By the merit of generosity and other perfections, may I attain Buddhahood for the sake of all sentient beings.
May all Mother sentient beings, boundless as the sky, have happiness and the causes of happiness.
May they be liberated from suffering and the causes of suffering.
May they never be separated from the happiness that is free from sorrow.
May they rest in equanimity, free from attachment and aversion.
May all Mother sentient beings, boundless as the sky, have happiness and the causes of happiness.
May they be liberated from suffering and the causes of suffering.
May they never be separated from the happiness that is free from sorrow.
May they rest in equanimity, free from attachment and aversion.
May all Mother sentient beings, boundless as the sky, have happiness and the causes of happiness.
May they be liberated from suffering and the causes of suffering.
May they never be separated from the happiness that is free from sorrow.
May they rest in equanimity, free from attachment and aversion.
So good afternoon. Welcome back to our short series on the topic of karma. The first two was last weekend, Saturday and Sunday. And now this is the third of the series. So let's see. So I know not all of you were here for the last two classes. And so what I'm going to do is kind of quickly summarize some of the main key points, and also probably good as a reminder for everyone that was here last week as well. And then maybe you all can also help me kind of identify some key things that we did learn about karma. The word karma is so much part of even the culture here that it's very recognizable on the one hand. But on the other hand, there is also a lot of confusion or a lot of misuse of the word karma. Misuse in the sense that it's not consistent. What I mean by that is it's not consistent with how perhaps Hindus think about karma, or how Buddhists think about karma, or how Jains think about karma. These being the three main religious traditions in India that share the same vocabulary of karma. So they share the same vocabulary for karma, but even among these three, the way they understand karma and how karma functions in each of these traditions are also quite different. Then, of course, when the general word, the term karma, comes over here, then it gets mixed up with, you know, kind of our cultural projections of what karma is. And so then karma becomes kind of, you know, you can make it mean anything you want it to mean, almost. Not quite. But there are general kind of, right, characteristics of how karma is used commonly in this culture that is recognizable. So, for example, I think karma here is understood as a force that makes sure that justice of some sort is kept. Right? Karma is going to bite you. And notions of karma being some kind of natural system of retribution. And then also notions of karma being somehow fated. Like, it's close to being fate. It's close to being predestination.
And then perhaps the strongest one is that karma is invoked when bleep happens. When something negative has happened, then, oh, this must be karma. Or this must be bad karma. And also karma almost always used as just bad things. And then we say karma. Then when good things happen, we say, oh, thank you, universe. Or something like, oh, I was just lucky. Right? So when good things happen, I was just lucky. I understand that. That comes from a place of being modest, because you don't want to brag. Well, I did good things in the past, because that's the understanding of karma. I did good things in the past, so now I deserve it. So you don't want to say that. So then you say, oh, just I was just lucky. Oh, you know, like, oh, thank the universe. But regardless of what we say, I think deeper down, we actually don't even think of karma. We just generally think that, I don't know, it just happened. When something good. When something bad happens, for many of us, it will be either like, oh, karma is one response, or again, like, I don't know why it happened, just bad luck. That's another one. The universe is teaching me a lesson. What can I learn from this, right? Again, all of these are possible explanations. So the purpose of this course, this series, is not to persuade you that those are definitely wrong, and here is, you know, exactly the reason why. And what I'm trying to do here is to help us, myself included, to have a clearer idea as to what we can say the Buddha probably taught about karma. So we're mostly looking at the earliest layer of recorded teachings attributed to the Buddha. I'm speaking with more kind of my academic background and not wanting to just make these pronouncements like, yes, this is what Buddha taught. But this is as reliable as we can get. Because for a long time in the Buddha's case, his teachings weren't written down. Now, not because his disciples didn't know how to write, but the context of India is that religious matters weren't committed to writing for a long, long time, until much later. Writing, when they were used to record mundane things, such as commerce, such as recording history, such as reporting what happened. But sacred things, there was a strong feeling, should not be written down. So same applied to Buddha's teachings. It is said that right after the Buddha passed away, there was a concern among his immediate disciples that we all, you know, kind of have a good idea and, for the sake of unity, also a good understanding and an agreement as to what the Buddha taught or did not teach. So we say, you know, so they got together. They got together to, it is said, to recite from memory. And people during those times had incredible memory, because spiritual texts had to be memorized. So they got together and they collected these teachings and passed them down through memory. It wasn't until a few hundred years later that these remembered texts, these oral texts, were put into writing. So where I'm drawing from for this series are from this earliest layer of the Buddhist texts that were collected in this early period. Just as a side note, you know, just so you also understand where I'm coming from, I don't necessarily think that is the limit of what we could call the Buddha's teachings. Obviously, for those of you who know, I practice in a tradition that, you know, greatly emphasizes texts that, at least historically, came from a later period. But for me, I see enough continuity. I see that, you know, these are still teachings of the Buddha. So I'm not fundamentalist in insisting that only the earliest layer. But if we want to learn something about karma and kind of the historical Buddha's distinctive kind of contribution or understanding of the matter of karma, then I do think that it is justified that we go to the earliest layer of historical texts available to us. And this is the texts, at least the ones that are available in English, right now, the most complete of this earliest layer comes from the Pali Canon. Comes from the Pali Canon. The Pali Canon is the formal canon of the Theravada tradition. And Theravada Buddhism is the Buddhism that is that dominates places like Thailand, Sri Lanka, Burma, Laos, Cambodia. There are also, from this earliest layer, texts preserved in the Chinese translation of Sanskrit, and certain Tibetan translations of the Sanskrit. But those texts generally have not been translated into English, so, you know, we're not looking at them. And also then finally, if you want to follow up and read more about this, I've mentioned that a very helpful resource is this website called Access to Insight. Access to Insight. And on there, all the Pali texts of the Pali canon, almost all of it has been translated into English. And not only that, the main scholar monk responsible for that website, an American out in California, he has also written a number of essays and also a number of study guides on many of these key topics. So in fact, a lot of what I'm drawing from are from Bhikkhu Tanisaro, his study guides. Of course, I'm not claiming to giving credit where credit should be given, but his take on the material could be slightly different from, you know, how I'm talking about it. So don't be surprised if you go there and read his essays. There might be some differences, but, you know, that's good. That's fine. Yeah. Can we take away these texts from chairs? Thank you. If someone can collect the text, Jimmy, please. So last week, one of the points that I made last week is to emphasize how this notion that the Buddha spoke about karma and taught karma half-heartedly. Yeah, there is this idea. In fact, among quote-unquote secular Western Buddhists, and this is a fairly strong movement, people who have looked to Buddhism and are very happy and comfortable with certain aspects of Buddhism, but not at all happy or comfortable with other aspects. They see themselves as secular Buddhists, so not religious, not into the chanting, not into the mythology. Take all of that out. Or, if at all, just look at that in a, you know, kind of secular humanist way. Teachings about karma, and especially about rebirth or multiple lifetimes, many would consider, oh, this is simply because the Buddha lived at a time where everybody believed that, therefore he also taught that. And with regards to that, two main positions. One position more flattering than the other. One position is to say, he was, after all, even though we sort of think he was awake, enlightened, he was, after all, a product of his times. And so because his times believed in karma, then being a product of his times, he just, you know, got swept along kind of believing that. But we know better, ha ha ha. There's that undertone, really, like I feel. We know better, ha ha ha. Now that we are enlightened, really enlightened, living in these times, you know, how silly. But we'll put up with that because he has other things to say that we really like. Right? The other position is more that, not that he didn't know, but he knew. But because his audience was so caught up with the idea of karma and multiple lifetimes, if he came out right to say, no, 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 these things don't matter, nobody would listen to him. And so in order to fit in better, he spoke a vocabulary that his people expected him to speak. So this one is slightly more indulgent. But I would submit, and many Buddhists will say, there is really no way to really say that you are practicing Buddha's teachings if you don't take his teachings on karma and his teachings on many lifetimes, multiple lifetimes, seriously. Now again, we're not saying, I'm not saying that in a dogmatic way, you have to. I'm saying, give it a chance and see why it might be that it won't hold up that well, his teachings, if you don't take karma seriously and you don't take the idea of multiple lifetimes seriously. And I will try to kind of present this without, you know, having you feel that it is an article of faith or belief that you have to subscribe to without good reason. Yes, it's still an article of faith or trust. Yeah? But if you're going to adopt it, I will say that it is possible to adopt it based on reasoning. Based on kind of good consideration that then I can kind of put myself, you know, to accept this as something that is profitable or maybe beneficial, or more kind of the language that the Buddha used, it is skillful. It is skillful to subscribe to this particular view. This particular view of why things happen and also how it happens in some ways. In terms of how it happens, of course, is not claiming to give you a scientific explanation of why, of how things happen, but from within the Buddhist kind of understanding, how it happens in terms of the continuity of lifetimes. So one of the so last week what we looked at then is first on karma. We didn't really talk that much about the continuity of lifetimes, which we'll look at a little bit today. But what we looked at last week is to start by asking what were the available ideas with regards to why things happen, or more specifically, why things that I consider either good or bad happens to me. Not so much why things happen as in why is the sun shining on that side and not that side, right? But rather, why do good or bad things happen to me? With reason or without reason? So we looked at how in one place the Buddha taught, he says that it seems that there are these three positions that religious people, he says, tend to hold on to. And all three of them, he said, they are deficient. The first position, he says, is the idea that everything that happens, all that happens, and the good and the bad things that happen to us completely because of past karma. And he rejected that. Then the second one, he says, everything good and bad that happens to us is the doing of an all-powerful God. Or for that matter, an all-powerful power that is not me, over there, right, is responsible for all the good and the bad things that I experience. Third position, he says, are those who say, all good and bad things happen to us. All good and bad things happen to us for no reason. For no reason. And all three of those positions, he rejected. And when we look more into that and ask, why did he reject the three? He didn't say to his audience, I rejected the three because when I woke up, when I became Buddha, through my power to see everything as it is, I saw it this way. So we get a sense of how he functioned as a teacher. He never said, because I said so. And because you trust me so much, therefore, I'm sure you would accept so. But as a teacher, he often used reasoning with whoever he was teaching. And so, with regards to the issue of karma, or the issue of asking of why good or bad things happen to us, in that discussion, when he brought up those three positions, his main point was what? Can you anyone remember? His objections.
Inactivity.
Sorry? Inactivity. So what does it mean, inactivity?
You feel like it's not worth doing.
Feel. Yeah. That's key. He was concerned that if you subscribe to any of these three, that you feel that there is no meaning to choose one kind of action over another kind. Because karma has decided, fate has decided, no matter what I choose, it won't make a difference. If everything is karma ripening from the past, so anything I do or don't do now, let's just leave it to karma. And of course, we use that phrase, let's just leave it to karma. He rejected that understanding of karma. A powerful force outside has determined this would render meaningful action pointless and impossible. The position of this happened for no rhyme or reason also renders action meaningless. So you can see that he was concerned about having people believe that it is possible to change our experiences. More specifically, it is possible for us to change whatever unpleasant experiences that we're experiencing now, that it's possible to change. And that to speculate too much about how it's the ripening of past karma, and therefore there's nothing I can do about it, or even when I'm doing this, is it simply the ripening of my good karma that I'm doing something about it, or when I'm doing this, is it actually just some God that has determined that I will do this, and so everything that I do is already decided? And when people try to take him along those lines, when he talked about karma, he will say, you are now getting yourself walking deeper and deeper into a thicket of views that will get you all tied up, and it will lead to nowhere good. So he rejected those because he was primarily concerned about having people understand the possibility of acting at any point, that we could create karma and kind of put things in a certain context, put things along certain momentum, so certain directions, that would make a difference. Then we also looked at the six prevalent views, or actually the non-orthodox view. In that case, he did not address the mainstream view of his time. But these six are actually the six kind of emerging kind of views about why things happen. And so we went over those six views. The first one is basically called non-action. And there, it's the idea, basically, if I could kind of, my read of that position is a position that says that ideas of like moral good or bad are essentially human constructs, that to bother ourselves with too much of that is taking us away from nature as it is. So it's kind of a form of naturalism that says that the best way to live, the most meaningful way to live, is to live naturally and not worry about these categories. And so the Buddha rejected that. The second one has this idea of, the second position does talk about multiple lifetimes. And in fact, presents this idea that all of us have already been allotted, or all of us are part of an evolutionary process whereby the soul would have to go through all these rebirths, a finite number of rebirths that seems to be all fixed for every one of us. And it's evolutionary. You get better. Then what you should do is to understand that this is the thing and just let everything unfold. And do not try to do anything to speed up this process or to slow it down, but just to go. And so the example of like if you roll a ball of yarn, it will just unfurl until the whole ball unfurls, and then that's it. And so this second position, the Buddha also rejected and say, no, it will not undo itself. The third position is called annihilation. And this is sort of the idea that, and this is the materialist position, which is, there's nothing after this life. All that we are just the elements. At death, all these elements go back to everything. So the good life now that we live is to live with this understanding and just be good people, basically. And then when it's over, it's all over. That's it. The Buddha also rejected that. This one, I think, comes closest to kind of the secular position that we're familiar with. It says, you know, yeah, be good people. And then that's it. After that, that's it. You know, don't worry about it. Then there is the position which is called non-relatedness, which perhaps bear resemblances to certain religious traditions, where here it says, and this is a particular Indian style, kind of theistic or soul-based tradition. The gist of it is saying that there is the soul and it's permanent. But in this system, there are seven types of permanent substances. And these permanent seven types of permanent substances, four of them are physical: earth, wind, fire, and water. Then there is a physical immutable substance, permanent substance, called pleasure and pain, and then soul. Seven. And it says that these seven are actually not related. They superficially create the illusion that they are in this person. And then they gave the example, but even if you took a sword and slashed through, you cannot destroy the earth, you cannot destroy the wind, you cannot destroy the water, you cannot destroy the soul. And so you should have that understanding. So whether pain or pleasure is being experienced, understand that it's just pain, just pleasure. Nothing else. It's called non-relatedness. And then he gave the position of the fourfold restraint, which is the tradition found among the Jains. Now, to be fair, this presentation of the Jain tradition is more a caricature of what Jains believe. And so here it talks about the fourfold restraint. I looked it up last week. I said, you know, I don't know exactly what this is referring to. But here, as I look, and it's more like a caricature of what the Jains believe. But it has to do with playing with the word restraint and water. They're kind of linked Sanskrit or Pali. Water and restraint. And then the idea that the emphasis in the Jain tradition on freeing the jiva, the eternal soul, from being in bondage. So we talked about how for them, although it's not presented in the handout, they weren't like explained in those terms, but for them it's like this idea that karma is everything that we do. Everything that we do, whether with intention, without intention, whether positive, whether negative, they all produce a type of substance that trapped us, that traps the jiva to the body. And so the ultimate in the spiritual, kind of a spiritual endeavor, is to basically cease creating any and all karma. And the best way to die is to stop eating and drinking. And stop, because the karma of eating and drinking is one of the heavier types of karma, because it involves consuming other life forms, including vegetables. So one very extreme kind of faction of this tradition even says being vegetarian is not enough. You should only eat plants that have leaves that have fallen off the tree by themselves. Then you can eat that. So their ideal is to get more and more and more, and or rather less and less and less involved in causing harm until you starve yourself to death. That way you can free. Buddha rejected that as an extreme position. Finally, the last one is called evasion. And this one is not so much that they have a position. This is, they absolutely don't have a position, and they insist that you should not have a position either. When asked why things happen, it says, don't know, don't ask. Easier that way, better that way. So I mentioned this bumper sticker that I saw. It says, radical agnostic. The big words. And then underneath it says, I don't know and you don't know either. It's not just agnostic, but radical agnostic. I don't know and you don't know either. So this Buddha says, you know, they are like these eel wrigglers. And they just wriggle themselves out of explaining anything. He rejected all six of these positions as not conducive. The common phrase is not conducive to the holy life. Not conducive to a life of training. So instead, throughout his life, he gave what he considered to be conducive understanding to living a good life. So he shared with all the others of his time, those who accepted the word karma, he shared with them the understanding that actions produce results. We talked about how here we're talking about moral actions producing moral results. We're not talking about the effect of your action, the kind of the obvious effect of your action. So, you know, the obvious effect of my action of punching, you know, Jimmy in the face is that, you know, it'll be a bloody nose, it'll be very painful, and he'll be very upset. That is not the karmic effect. That's not the result that we're talking about. The result that we're talking about is the result that will boomerang back to me for having punched him in the face. That's what the result that we're talking about here. So alongside his contemporaries, other religious figures, Buddha accept that karma is about that. It's about that actions, these types of actions produce results. Where he differed from some of them is his emphasis on intention. And so there's a quote from him that says, intention, I tell you, is karma. Intending, one does karma by way of body, speech, and intellect. And so for him, intention was important. And so in contrast to the Jain position where they felt that intention or not, your actions produce consequences. But here the Buddha emphasized that, no, it's only actions that are performed, that are carried out due to intentions. And then there he specifically isolates, he says, and particularly the intentions that are driven by the three poisons. For sure, they create negative. Those are what I call negative karma, he says. And what are the three poisons? Greed, ill intent, and confusion or ignorance. So any kind of intention fueled by these three poisons, then definitely karma is created. And the karma that is created, you can call negative karma. Actions are also karma if their intentions are free from greed. And when these intentions are free from greed, not powered by greed, not propelled by ill intent, not propelled by confusion, then they are positive karma. Then they are positive karma. Then when it comes to karma, The Buddha says, so there are some general characteristics of karma. One general characteristic of karma is said to be, it is inevitable. What does it mean by inevitable? Any ideas? The inevitability of karma.
You cannot escape it.
Say a little bit more.
So if you have created the conditions for something to happen, then something will happen.
Okay. So here, inevitable is that, yeah, actions never fail to produce an effect. Actions, karma, karmic actions will definitely produce karmic effects. But then that statement, later we will see, what it is saying is not so much that it will definitely produce a result. Here, when it says it will definitely produce a result, what does it mean? Okay, rephrase. Can we now have it will definitely produce a result unless what?
There's some intervention to make it.
There is some intervention, right. So intervention is possible. So it is not the case that once it is created, for sure, it will produce result.
Because both the causes and the conditions have to come together for it to
run. The causes need to meet the right conditions, and then the conditions that are met may or may not be strong conditions. Or also the notion that you could destroy the seed before it bears fruit, before it sprouts. Yeah?
Then it's not inevitable.
It's not inevitable. But you find phrases where the Buddha says that. And that's when we have to interpret that and say, what does he mean there? And if you look at the context, there he's emphasizing, you see, all these teachings that he gives, it's all in conversation. He never quite just gives a sermon. It's always in conversation with someone. So the places where he makes a pronouncement, therefore karma is inevitable, I can say it's always in a context where someone is saying, well, maybe it won't. Maybe it won't bear fruit. Maybe I don't have to worry about it. Then that is when he says, uh-uh. No, it will bear fruit. Later, in other conversations, or not later, but in elsewhere, in other conversations, when someone says, I'm doomed, I'm doomed, I'm doomed. That's when he goes, no, you're not. Yes, very terrible things have been done. But you know what? You can still now do something to prevent the karmic results from coming.
Is he saying that you will prevent any karmic result, or just you can ameliorate the result?
In some cases, you can ameliorate. In some cases, you
totally
can...
totally wipe it out.
Burn the seed.
I see. Okay.
Yeah. He does talk about burning the seeds.
Would it be right to say that the seed is inevitable, but the fruit, the result, isn't?
No, like some places, he does say the fruit is inevitable. I think it's just we can't absolutize
his
statements.
Is it because the present moment has changed? In the original present moment, the karma is inevitable.
Yes.
Now later, it's a different present moment, and the karma...
Well, that's like kind of commentarial gymnastics that they have to do later on.
In other words...
Yeah, no, I understand, I understand.
Karma before was...
Yes, I understand, yes.
Now, it's a different present moment.
Yeah, that's just commentarial gymnastics.
What does that mean?
Huh?
What does that mean?
Gymnastics involves a lot of contorting bodies. So later, Buddhists have the burden of explaining away why the Buddha said in this case is inevitable, and over there he says it's, you can change it. I think that's just later Buddhists wanting...
Well, what seems important is that at any moment I don't feel defeatist about karma. I say I have free will,
yes.
I have intention, and let me couple that with
intention. Yes, and that's what the main thrust of...
Right.
His concern. But in occasions where people seem to say, I can deal with that later, then he takes a stronger position and say, this is going to come and you can't escape it.
Well, in hindsight, looking back. Yeah.
And so it's all about, we need to kind of take the larger picture and sort of interpret. Yeah. What was he trying to say there? To whom? You know, often what happens is with Buddhist tradition or any religious tradition, it's like the teacher is dead, so every single word now suddenly becomes like sacred and cannot be changed. And especially when they pick it out of context and line it all up, which is what they did later in the Abhidharma, they say, well, there are four qualities to karma. It is this, it is this, it is this, it is this. But after 200 years, right, people forgot, like, wait, what was the context when this was said? Now it has become like, you know, capital T truth. And it becomes dogma. Yes, Buddha did say actions never fail to produce an effect. But should we go from there to the conclusion that karma cannot be changed? No. If karma cannot be changed, why even bother? Right? Why even bother? Like he says, then the holy life is not possible. Forget about it.
So we're cluttering up these statements when we try to draw connections, which... some of us, like me, always do. We're better off without the connections and to just understand each in its own.
A thicket of views, the Buddha warns against. A thicket of views are good if you understand, I think. You know, like put it in context and it will give you like more kind of a more refined view of what's being said. So I'm not quite, you know, like the forest tradition on Milarepa that says, you know, I like ideas. Me, I'm just talking about me. So I also like to study, you know, these things like that says, you know, four characteristics of karma, you know. But I think we go too far when we think that's the final word. It's not. It's a bunch of people later on trying to basically kind of be able to kind of give the dummies, you know, guide to karma, the easy one, you know, so that when people say, well, Hindus believe this, what do you all believe? Well, we believe in these four things, right? And because it seems easy, but whenever you do something like that, you take away from, you know, the complexity of this topic, especially karma, because again and again the Buddha warned. He says, you know, remember the four types of things that he says you should not think too much about?
The imponderables?
The four imponderables? Yeah, it'll make you crazy, he says. One is the extent of the Buddha's freedom. You know, don't, he says. It'll make you crazy. The other one relevant here is exactly how an effect is related to a cause. You can't. Right? When you try to go into that, you'll get yourself into a thicket of views. But there are general things about karma that we need to be clear about. We cannot say, oh, I don't think about it. Right? So what we need to be clear about is this. There is no occasion where you can say, look, this person did something good and then bad things happened to him. Which a lot of times we kind of believe that. Or this person did something bad. Look, he's having a good time. Well, I know. Yes, that is a good case, you know? That we say that. And also it's a good case to analyze because the Buddha actually said, here is your problem if you think cause and effect all is only about this lifetime. Then you can point to all those people and say, well, why should I live a moral life? I should learn from that guy. They're having a jolly good time. Actually, that conversation that we ended with last week, he said, you know, I think I put it here. He actually said this is about rebirth, you know. He said, if you limit everything to just here and now, here's your problem. And then you just say, well, doesn't matter. I just need to figure out, you know, how to maximize my pleasure. Do it. Yeah, so he says, you need to be clear about this point. There is not, you. It's almost like I would say, he says, you should not believe that you can plant a mango seed and it will produce an apple tree. Even if it seems like, wait a minute, an apple tree has come up there. Yeah? It's almost like he's saying, you need to perhaps dogmatically reject that and say, no, no, no. Must be, you know, somewhere in there, the mango seed is still hidden. It's just that the apple seed was there, and I didn't see it. So I should not make this wrong connection. Now, right or wrong is based on what is a skillful way of framing our understanding. So it's almost like we cannot subscribe to a system of belief that says that doing bad things can result in good. So in that sense, this is, in a way, it's not about capital T truth. It's about, right? It's about what should we value? Now, of course, as Buddhist, and I can speak only for myself, I would say this is grounded in the Buddha's having seen the capital T truth. That he woke up to what was real. But as a matter of like subscribing to it, I don't think we need to require that you believe that this is capital T truth. But rather to follow the way he presents it, the way he argues it with people. He doesn't whack it over their heads and say, I saw the truth already. And if you don't believe it, you just can't handle the truth. He doesn't threaten people with that kind of reasoning. He's always like, wait, think about this. So that, right? That karma is not mistaken. That's another way of putting it. Karma is not mistaken. And that when karma, bright karma and dark karma, he says, when they ripen distinctly. Distinctly. So, some analogy given is that if you have a handful of grains that consists of barley, wheat, and rice, and then you hurl it into a plot, when it ripens, when it sprouts, they're not hybrids. The wheat will be the wheat, the barley will be the barley, the rice will be the rice. Now, if you happen to have a lot of rice and only a few, you know, wheat berries, superficially, when you look at here, you say, oh, that's a field of, you know, barley. Did I say barley or rice? Rice. That's becoming. So it's like you can say, "Oh, that's a field of rice," right? And then you can say, "Oh, so it doesn't matter if you mostly just plant rice and you have some wheat, because the wheat is not going to ripen." No, it's not that it's not going to ripen. It's just that superficially, when you stand far away, you don't see that it's there. So in that way, we have to be careful about our karma. Then in this understanding also, and this is the hard part, I'll phrase it strongly. There are no innocents. And there are no innocents. That means that, you know, when we experience suffering, right, it is likely the ripening of karma. And that, you know, you can't say, "I'm sinless. I'm a good person." This is not possible. Yeah. But neither could you use it to tell somebody else. "Oh, this is your karma ripening. Suck it up." You know? Because karma, the teaching on karma, isn't taught for us to go tell somebody else why they are experiencing something unpleasant. Later, we will look at how the Buddha's teaching about the inevitability and the certainty of karma, right, in this sense that we've talked about, interestingly, is taught within a system where there is no eternal abiding soul that is experiencing the results of karma. That's the interesting part. That's the part that we often miss. Then we suffer more when we have a kind of normal idea of me being a soul, me being an unchanging entity, and then add the idea of karma, then it becomes very heavy. Yeah. So today we want to look at more kind of the teachings about, you know, what is the self? How is self produced? Kind of like you could say the wisdom teachings. Now these are often the kind of teachings that a lot of people like about Buddhism, but they tend to yank it out of, or to separate karma and rebirth on the one side and the wisdom teachings on the other side, and say, this is just culture. This is just cultural stuff. We don't need this. This, the real stuff we want. But what we're going to look at this afternoon is how actually these two are tied together. That they are connected. And that if you have one without the other, you're going to run into some problems that the Buddha actually addressed. That they have to go hand in hand. So questions or comments so far? Anything to share? Thoughts? Rambles. That's good too. Yeah.
Is there any way, Professor, to see which bad actions I might have done, what bad karma they resulted in? Or do you just know when something bad happens to you, some bad karma back there somewhere is ripening?
There are places in the sutras where it does say, generally, for example, it said that if you have a bad health as a constant issue, then it's related to having caused harm to others, physical harm to others. Now, and again, inordinately, Buddhists through the centuries have focused on that or things like that. And so then it even leads to, last week I said, I have so many Buddhist friends, even teachers, who will say, oh, no, the Buddha taught, you know, if you squish a bug, you will be squished. If at some lifetimes you use a 6-inch blade, you know, to gut someone, watch out, a 6-inch blade is coming to gut you at some point. Because, again, how do they come to that? It's on that statement that, you know, karma is unmistaken, right? Similar causes produce a similar result, but like literally, right? So then they find passages in the sutras where it says, you know, where Buddha said to someone, you know, your illness, a constant illness here, is because of da 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 da. And then Buddha tells a story. And that's when, yes, Buddha is invoking faith. He says, in the past lifetime, you have this, 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 or that, right? There, I think, if we look closer at the material, when he uses that kind of explanation, it is not, to me, really giving that person an explanation as to why he or she is suffering from bad health now. In fact, he is saying in those instances that therefore now, even as you go see and consult a doctor, you need to also pay more attention to creating karma that supports and protects lives, feed people, provide medicine for others. And so he's using that as an opportunity to say, now go do good, and do the kind of good that is related to possibly the karmic effect of the problems that you're facing now. So to that degree, yes, you know, when you're doing this and Buddhist, you know, like, oh, it's because in the past life, and then going, oh, therefore now I should be careful about. Yeah.
What you just said reminds me of metta. So it's like that, how the practice of metta comes about. I mean, in that regards of then feeling what you're feeling, but then, you know, in the sense of wishing better for yourself or for others, how does that...
Yeah, yes. In I mean, you know, practicing metta meditation or whatever meditation is a kind of karma, right? You're creating now positive karma, right, as a way to counteract the negative. So in that sense, applying the antidote is a lot more along those lines.
So the truth is...
The truth? Just teasing.
Is that we really can't know, and it doesn't really matter that we know. We just take the opportunity to find ways to turn it into a more positive.
Yes.
So this is...
Right.
We believe the process. We don't have to understand.
Don't have to know the... Yeah.
Yes.
So is it... Does correlating good deeds... Are they more beneficial than... if your health is bad, than just going out and doing other good karma that's not related to health? Does it need to be a correlation?
It seems like there is a correlation, more so I think for a bigger picture kind of mental state, rather than, I can't speak to exactly if the actions, right? Although the text seems to suggest that. I'm trying to step back and say, I think it's more about, then you become more, it's more specific, kind of just and therefore more powerful than just generally just do good things. Right? It gives you more a sense of, and I think that is part of the healing. That I might have deprived someone of the psychology. I might have deprived someone of medicine in the past. And therefore, all the medicine that I'm taking now is not bearing any effect. Let me go provide good medicine to people now. And I think that psychology actually helps us to heal better.
It has intention, right?
It has very strong intention. Psychic placebo, which is the best kind of medicine. Right? It's like when people say, that's placebo effect. It's like, exactly, yay. We have been taught to reject placebo effect because pharmaceuticals can't sell them. That's being cynical. But, you know. It's like walking is so good for you, but they can't sell it. They're not going to put money into research on how good walking is. Yeah, unless they can tie it to the treadmill or fancy shoes or whatever, right? So there's a movement like to walk and to run bare feet. You're not going to get a lot of support, you know, to do research on that, because how can somebody sell bare feet? You can't. Other questions? Yeah.
Does regret play a part in any of this process?
Yes. So in some of the, does regret play a part? Actually, yes, it says that. So there is one section, and I don't want to go into too many of the later material, even though I find it very helpful. So maybe in the future we could do something, a course on, focus more on like how to purify karma, which we're not talking about here so much, you know. But here it does say, in later material, right, in the Abhidharma, in the commentary and everything, they go back and they see, you know, and so I would say sometimes they're more successful than other times. So in these later teachings, that to kind of draw out, you know, what could the Buddha mean, and, you know, kind of arrange a system, right? Buddha wasn't a systematizer. Jesus wasn't a systematizer. Then Paul came along. Then whoever came along, right? It's the people who comes later who have to systematize things, because we like it clean, right? So it says that, for example, what determines how strong a particular karma is? So that question arose later on. And so then Buddhist disciples, Buddhist scholars, had to go back to the text and look for all those places. And I think that we would do a more effective job today because, you know, we have search engines. Back then, they just have to rely on, you know, their memory, you know, and where to draw from. You know, now we could, like, you know, draw out everything and line up and say, you know, the algorithm and everything will kind of, you know, come up with like a good search, you know. But there it says, I remember, I think it's four. I don't know if I can remember all four, but you get an idea. It says, an action is extremely powerful when it is done to someone who is spiritually highly developed. Both positive and negative actions done towards these persons produce stronger effect. Yeah. Both positive and negative. Actions that are done to those who have been kindest to you also produces correspondingly stronger or weaker effects. So in other words, for example, to be ungrateful, yeah, to a random person who has done you some good, and to be ungrateful, yeah, to your parents, the karmic effect is different. Then, the karma is also different if after completing the action, you go, yes! Yeah. Or you go, ay, 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 gosh, why did I do that? That's the regret question. Both good and bad. And you have just given away, you know, your lunch. And you go, yes! That person will be so happy. Then the effect of that karma is strong. In this case, strongly good. But if, you know, you have given away, God, being generous is not a good thing. I have to control myself in the future. Then, it also correspondingly strong.
What about something that I often do? Mm-hmm. I mean, I give in different ways, but I go through phases of giving food.
Uh-huh.
And sharing.
Uh-huh.
Sharing and
uh-huh.
the big work.
Yeah.
But if I know or feel mm-hmm. that I have an enemy or someone who's been difficult mm-hmm. to be around or with,
mm-hmm.
I make a point
yes.
to give them something.
Uh-huh. That's good.
And I can usually walk away and go, wow, that was really hard. You know?
Uh-huh.
But I'm really
But that's
glad,
not regret.
But I'm really
yeah.
glad I did it.
Yes, that's not regret.
I don't right. always feel great about it.
Right.
And I often question, like,
you must not be Asian.
Why did I, you know?
I'm like, good, I'm giving him. Now they have the burden. Yes! Passive aggressiveness is not a negative in Asia. We call that being refined. I said, I don't remember all four. I can go look for it. Then they also say, this is more random, yeah? How, you know, the longer you wait, the stronger the effect. What does that mean? The stronger the effect will become. Specifically, this is related to negative karma that you've created. If you let it sit there longer without purifying it, it grows stronger and stronger and stronger. Likewise, the good that you produce, if you don't do the opposite, regret it, the longer it stays, yeah, the stronger it becomes. So here it has to do with now psychology, the imprints that it leaves on your mind. And so back to the thing, you know, like a very practical thing. Now, I've been talking a lot about like our sustaining membership program, right? So here, actually, someone in this room actually asked me this question before and said, yes, I know that it doesn't matter, you know, when it comes to the total figure that the center gets, you know, in a year from me, in a sense, whether I give it in 10 installments, 12 installments, or one time, yeah, that's how much, effectively, the center is going to get. Yeah? And the person said, now let's bracket that aside. Now let's talk about the spiritual effect. Yeah, and it is true, according to the teachings, it's better to give it in 12 installments that one time. Granted that you pay attention in the 12 installments and not just like mechanically say, oh, I'll do it 12 because it's better, but rather to kind of have the occasion to remember every first of the month, yeah, I give to something good. Psychologically, it says, it's good because we don't get reminded. And in the Buddhist context, you don't need to deprive yourself of being reminded that you have done something good. We don't see that as a negative. In some cultures, that's seen as a negative.
I don't know. I've done something good. Yeah.
Like, with a really kind of, you know. Maybe that's, you know, in reaction to, on the other hand, there are those who flaunt, you know, the good that they've done. Right? So then we swing the other direction, like, I want to do good, I don't want to think about it anymore. What the Buddha taught is that actually, when you've done something positive, you should enhance that by rejoicing. The yes! And then when you've done something negative, you should enhance it with regret. Regret is a good thing when you know how to use it. Regret is a bad thing if it means I am doomed, nothing I can do anymore. But regret is good because if you know how to apply it to some unskillful thing that you've done, and you say, no, I really didn't like that doing that. You know, circumstances. Not related, well, related to karma, sort of like, there is a mental faculty in Buddhist analysis of the mind called shame that is actually good. Again, you know, normally we think shame is bad. But it says that shame and regret are the pre and the post that will prevent us from creating negative karma. Yeah, not wanting to be censured by people we care about or the community, that's a good kind of shame. Again, a certain person is shameless. There, that positive mental faculty of shame doesn't operate. You know? And so they do things shamelessly. Definitely regret seems to be out of the picture too. Then very negative karma is created. For sure. So Buddha said, you know, shame is good. If applied skillfully, then no, you should not. So let's take a break now, and then when we come back, we'll look at this handout for today.
Thank you for listening to the Urban Dharma NC podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, we hope you'll consider supporting our mission to foster a deeper understanding of the teachings of the Buddha, to build meaningful community, and to integrate contemplative teachings into everyday life. We invite you to make a donation online at udharmanc.com. Thank you. May all beings benefit.